In baseball, he has ownership in six minor league teams, including the Normal Corn Belters, but his legacy will always include the disco fiasco.
And I hope they don't let you people see what's going on here at Comiskey Park. One of the saddest sights I've ever seen in a ballpark in my life. This garbage of demolishing a record has turned into a fiasco.
In 1977, the White Sox, with whom I labored at the time, had a promotion with disco clubs all around Chicago. And at the end of the evening, Jeff Schwartz, who was a record plugger at that time for United Artists, and a group of us retired to Miller's Pub, which I'm happy to say still stands in downtown Chicago. And we discussed what we thought was a blight on the American music scene, disco. And we thought it would be really fun to have a night honoring rock and roll music for all the people who didn't care for disco and loved rock and roll. We went home laughing at 4 a.m. and never thought about it again until Steve Dahl on WLUP blew up a disco record. And about 5 minutes after Mr. Dahl got off the air, I called him and said, "You want to do that live at Comiskey Park?" And he said, "Well, I've only done it at shopping centers." And I said, "Well, go practice, because we're going to do it between games of a Twi-Night doubleheader against the Tigers." And so July 12th came, and I told everyone we were going to have 35,000 people, and they thought that was the funniest thing they ever heard. And there were 35,000 people lined up at 3 o'clock. So we opened the gates at 4 o'clock. It was a Twi-Night doubleheader, a long extinct. You'll never see one of those again, except for two admissions. And we opened the gates. There were 60,000 people in Comiskey by 6 o'clock. And after losing the first game, the kids ran out on the field.
It's not a scene that I want to remember very long.
No, not for in baseball. And I certainly hope that there's an example being made here that something like this will never happen again, not only for this ballpark, but for all ballparks around the country.
As they say, the rest is history. Jane Byrne rode in. The riot squad came in after an hour. We were forced to forfeit. My dad looked at me and said, "Every once in a while, you have one that works too well." He was actually the only one who understood it. It did not do wonders for my baseball career from there on.
You sort of went on a bit of a downward spiral after that personally. I mean, that emotionally, yeah, you know, those were some tough times for you following that event.
That's putting it mildly. I just went right off the deep end, ran right off the deep end. You know, you're hearing on the street behind your back purportedly that this would cost your potentially Hall of Fame father. It was a disgrace. And of course, I didn't know what a slow news day meant, which meant that everybody wrote about it. Had there been something else going on, it would have been relegated, you know, to maybe not so large an amount of coverage. But I hit the sauce pretty good after that, and didn't work again in the big leagues for 10 years.
There was some cost involved in that, and I'm sure that created some issues for your father as well.
Oh, yeah. It's a marketing man's nightmare, actually, to have a promotion that goes, as I said, almost too well. Too many people show up, and you end up forfeiting what was then only the fourth game in the history of Major League Baseball. And there comes a a real onus with that. But I refused then, John, to apologize in terms of this being a terrible tragedy. You know, I know what tragedies are. We all know what tragedies are. We see them every day. Those are veterans who don't have enough to eat, or children who can't walk. Those are tragedies. Forfeiture of a ball game doesn't rate very high up there. That was all I said, and of course the press just killed me for that. But now I'm happy to say that ever since the 25th anniversary, people kind of look back on this event now with kind of a warm and fuzzy approach, as opposed to the first 10 or 15 years in which I was a pariah.
Baseball team owner Mike Vec speaking with Illinois Public Radio's Sean Crawford. Today is the 33rd anniversary of Disco Demolition Night at Comiskey Park in Chicago. Last evening, Closing Market Report host Todd Gleason was traveling through Watsika, and he passed by a young man with a sign on his back that said, "New York to California." Todd's a curious guy. He couldn't resist finding out more.
My name is James DiGiovanni. I'm walking from New York to California. Today's day 61. Yep, day 61. And kind of just doing it to see the country in a unique way, 25 miles at a time, meet people along the way, and see what the country's really like.
What prompted you to do this, James, and how old are you?
I'm 24 years old. I just turned 24 a week ago today. And I've driven around the country a lot. And to me, when you're driving around, you kind of get enclosed in your car, usually stay on the interstates, you only stop at rest stops or gas stations, and that's, to me, that's no way to really see the country. So I think this will be my opportunity to take 6 months and really take my time while I don't have all the commitments like a wife and a mortgage and kids and car payments and that kind of stuff, and kind of take my time across the country and really see what people are like.
What did you do for a living?
I just finished a master's degree in moral and political philosophy. So I finished that up in early May and took off right away. Within a week of finishing the program, I was on the road walking.
What's the most unique experience you've had in the 61 days?
It's just been the people over and over. Just last night, I was invited into somebody's house, and instead of having to sleep outside of my tent, I got to sleep on a nice, comfortable couch, and I was given breakfast and a shower and that kind of stuff. And it's just, I continue to be amazed every day by the generosity of the people that I come across.
How long do you expect? You expect this to take 6 months, so you're 2 months into it now, and you're about a third of the way across.
Yeah, I left on May 12th, so I'm kind of shooting for November 12th as the six-month point. And if all goes according to plan, I'll be swimming in the Pacific Ocean by November 12th at the latest.
Tell me about what you're wearing, your gear, and your cart.
I'm wearing what most people think is clothing that's far too warm, but it's actually long sleeves, gloves, a flap to cover my neck, that kind of stuff. This way, the only thing that's really exposed to the sun is my nose sticking out. This way, it's all good, kind of sweat-wicking, lightweight material, a light color, especially on a hot day like today and with how high it's been over the last week. Really important to have the right clothing. And all of my gear, rather than have it on my back, you can imagine 100 degrees out what it would be like to have 50 or 60 pounds on your back. Instead, I have what is really a modified jogging stroller with a couple of Rubbermaid bins on it. One bin that I keep filled with food, and the other bin I keep filled with your basic camping equipment, tent, sleeping bag, some clothes, that kind of stuff.
You have a website. How are you able to keep it up while you're walking along?
Yeah, I do have a website, jameswalking.com, and I have my iPhone with me so I can update the website and make sure my friends and family know I'm alive and that I'm doing well and that kind of stuff.
You spend the night in hotels or on the street?
I avoid hotels as much as I can. There's sitting in a hotel room by yourself is no way to meet people. So at the end of the night, whenever my feet get tired or hours after my feet get tired, I'll knock on somebody's door and ask if I can pitch my tent in their yard. And people have been amazingly receptive to it. I barely get anybody saying no. And very often I'm also offered dinner or breakfast or a shower or laundry or a place to sleep inside. I've been really impressed by how generous people have been.
James, good luck.
Thank you very much.
James DiGiovanni. He was interviewed by Todd Gleason of the University of Illinois Extension. He's also the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week on WILL. You can find out where James is right now by visiting the map page on his website, jameswalking.com.
Come along on our custom-designed trip to England and Wales this September. Experience the real Downton Abbey in a private tour just for friends of WILL. See lovely Cotswold villages, the Yorkshire countryside, and meet Alan J. W. Bell, producer of Last of the Summer Wine. Tour Greenway, Agatha Christie's home, the English spa town of Bath, and visit the Jane Austen Center before wrapping up the trip in London. Our tour is almost full, so call 217-333-7300 for more information.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 12th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of Henry David Thoreau, born in Concord, Massachusetts, 1817. Went to Harvard, didn't care for that, nor did he enjoy working as a schoolteacher afterward. Worked in his father's pencil factory, came up with a better way to bind graphite and clay, and then in 1844, his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson bought land on the shore of Walden Pond, and Thoreau decided to build a cabin there, 2 miles from the village. Lived there for 2 years, kept a journal that he later published as Walden or Life in the Woods, in which Thoreau wrote, "I learned this, at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours." It's the birthday of the poet Pablo Neruda, born in Parral, Chile, in 1904. When he was 19 years old, Neruda sold all of his possessions so that he could publish his first book, Crepuscolario Twilight. And because his father did not approve of his writing poetry, he did not publish it under his given name, Neftali Ricardo Reyes Basualto, but under the pen name Pablo Neruda. And in 1924, he published Veinte Poemas de Amor y una Canción Desesperada, in English, 20 love poems and a song of despair. Pablo Neruda, who always wrote in green ink because he believed it was the color of hope. And it was 50 years ago today, a band called the Rolling Stones played their first gig, 1962. Brian Jones put an ad in a newsletter announcing auditions for a rhythm and blues band. Two roommates, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, showed up, who both loved blues. They'd formed a band of their own, Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. Brian Jones was on the phone with the Jazz News, and the reporter asked him what the band was called. He looked over at a Muddy Waters album lying on the floor. One track was Rolling Stone Blues, and he said the Rolling Stones. July 12th, 1962, they played at the Marquee Club in London, opened with the Lieber and Stoller song Kansas City, and also played Chuck Berry's Back in the USA. A new book, The Rolling Stones 50, is going to be released today, marking their golden anniversary.